From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm Rabbi Jack Moline, filling in this week for your host, Welton Gaddy. We're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. State of Belief Radio is made possible in large part by the generous support of our listeners. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, the Muslim post-Ramadan observance of Eid al-Fitr continues through Tuesday. Rastafarians celebrate the birthday of Emperor Haile Selassie on Thursday. And on Friday, Mormons will mark Pioneer Day. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
What are the mechanisms for teaching about Judaism, about Buddhism, about Christianity?
Around the world, different religious convictions define and drive so many of the conflicts we see today. But religious convictions and their teachings also offer many of the available solutions. With respect and understanding across these traditions being so important, who's preparing tomorrow's leaders to advance these efforts? One exciting new initiative is an interreligious leadership degree program established by Andover Newton Theological Seminary and Hebrew College. We'll get the details from Islamic scholar-in-residence Celine Ibrahim Lizia.
Pluto is a favorite, whether you call it a planet or a dwarf planet. It is a very beloved member of our solar system.
Of all the disappointments science has handed us over the years and centuries, the sun doesn't revolve around us, smoking isn't good for you, a particularly sad moment for all of us came in 2005 when astronomers officially demoted Pluto from the list of planets. With brand new discoveries once again challenging what we think we know about this celestial body, it got me thinking about what and who we believe. And we'll delve into the topic when Rabbi Elliot Dorf joins me on this week's State of Belief. But first,
this was the moment history was made in the state of South Carolina.
Thank you, South Carolina. It's coming down.
So this afternoon, the controversial flag will disappear from the State House. A move unthinkable just a few weeks ago.
Against all the odds, last month's church shooting tragedy in Charleston brought out the best in so many people. From the vote to finally lower the Confederate battle flag from over the South Carolina State House, to renewed discussion of racism across the country, the tragic loss of life has sparked a summer of conscience in many. Always at the forefront of faith-driven activism on behalf of justice is the National PICO Network. And I'm very pleased to welcome Pastor Mike McBride, who heads up the Lifelines to Healing campaign, back to State of Belief Radio. Mike, thanks for being with us again.
Great to be here with you, Jack. Thank you.
Mike, will you start by describing some of the activism that PICO has been promoting since Charleston?
We have really, over the last month or so, had to focus much of our efforts to help create an environment where people can lament and people can mourn the realities that are continuing to face us, this truth that many of us in this generation are still fighting some of the very fights that our grandparents had to fight. And I think our congregations and faith leaders have all had to lean upon one another's collective wisdom, collective faith, collective courage, and our collective spirit to help shepherd our communities through a very difficult moment.
So when people hear activism, they generally think of political action. But you're really talking about pastoral activism. How much resonance is this finding in the African-American community?
Yeah, I think it's always important to appreciate that the history of Black life in this country has not been one where you can pick or choose what kind of resistance or action you're going to take. Just the act of waking up every day and loving yourself, your family, your God is actually an act of resistance and activism, both spiritually, physically, politically, financially, et cetera. So we have had to continue to create a framework and an affirmative space where Black folk and brown folk, poor folk, people who find themselves living on the margin, do not have to compartmentalize their lives in ways that actually are not life-giving. And in this way, we have been training congregations and clergy to engage in ministry and action that is about saving not just the soul, but the body as well, paying attention to not just the spirit but the mind. And in this way, our activism, our actions, hopefully that are faith-filled, are able to pay attention to the holistic nature of how our lives are continuously bound up in systems and structures that reinforce oppression, that remind us that in this country we are still not seen as fully human, much less fully included as citizens in the United States of America. In many respects, people of color in this country are under an assault that is very public, that is very psychological and physical. And we are fighting for our lives. We're fighting for the lives of our families, our communities, and our neighborhoods. And when we see that our houses of worship, which continue to serve in the reality of our communities, the soul of our of Black life, are under attack, when we see that so many of our men and women are continuing to be assaulted and killed at alarming rates by state violence, when we see the forces of economic exploitation, when we see the forces of school-to-prison pipeline in our schools all across the country, when we see all these manifestations, at some point, our communities can't continue to try to appeal to folks who can see the same realities and continue to assert that there is something wrong with we who are being subjected to them. I think at this moment, we are about self-preservation, and we're inviting particularly people of faith to pull on the best that our faith traditions teach us, to say that you rejoice with those who rejoice and you mourn with those that mourn, that we, the strong, ought to carry the burdens of the weak, that we ought to love one another and embrace one another. I think we're appealing to those folks who have a moral sense of duty and responsibility and connectedness to humanity. And I think those folks don't need to be convinced. I think the evidence is overwhelming in this moment. And I think the coalition of the willing, of the compassionate, is building and growing. And this is why I continue to believe we will win.
That's a remarkable message, Mike. You know, I've noticed that it is so often the tension that's created around an issue that spurs people to change. But if something breaks that tension, the will to change will sometimes dissipate. Now, the removal of the Confederate battle flag from the South Carolina Capitol grounds struck me as a moment just like that. How do we keep our momentum going in the afterglow of what is genuinely just a symbolic victory? It really doesn't change anything.
Well, I think we ask different kinds of questions, right? So I think, you know, we start to ask. Dr. William Barber has written a powerful piece that I will commission to all of the listeners that talks about, does Black life matter in America, or does only Black death matter in America? Meaning that the call for things like the Confederate flag, which is an emblem of white supremacy and systematic oppression, undergirded by a governor, by a legislature, by a culture of degradation, not just in the South, but all throughout this country, the reality that that is allowed to continue and persist, right? And that the only thing that really triggered the removal of that flag were 9 innocent individuals being killed in a church. The reality that we who are alive and have been alive for decades have been calling for the removal of the symbol, not getting any traction on the structure itself, but that it, the most we can get is a symbol removed as a result of Black death, should force us to ask different kinds of questions. What then will it take to remove the systems of oppression that are literally killing people every day? The systems of white supremacy that are literally rewarding the 1% wealth elite in our country, leaving all other folks of all races and all economic backgrounds and all geographic locations out in the cold. What will it take for us to be able to take seriously that we're living in a moment and a time where symbols seem to matter more than substance? And I want to believe that as the president is showing up today, taking what many of us believe is an important, we certainly all wish this would have happened several years ago or, you know, some time ago, but we give him much credit that he's beginning to sound the alarm today, coming into Oklahoma, and now you see that people are meeting the president of the United States with Confederate flags on his way to go visit a prison. I think it just continues to say to me and to many of us that our country has an element of white supremacy, racial animus, that the removal of symbols will not be able to address. And Dr. King says that a law may not make you love me, but a law will keep you from lynching me. And we're in a moment where we need to look at systems, structures, and policies that will guard us against the very blatant and covert expressions of racism and white supremacy.
I know that mass incarceration is a leading priority of the Lifelines for Healing campaign, which is part of what PICO does. Tell me about the importance of President Obama's prison visit.
We do believe that the president's visit to this prison is an important step of symbolic importance. Hopefully, it will lead to a continued building momentum of policy and structural change and reform. The president has definitely, over the last several days, created some very powerful public statements around reforming the criminal justice system, talking about how the shifting of billions of dollars from jails and prisons to rehab and education and economic revitalization. All of those are important political statements and hopefully projects. So we think that there is a number of opportunities that are coming up in the next 90 days. The president could sign an executive order to ban the box on all federal jobs and contractors, which would open up several million jobs for former incarcerated and folks with felony records to be able to compete in the economy without legalized discrimination. The president could continue to make sure that HUD is not discriminating against individuals because they may have criminal history. We could certainly begin to make sure that there is a federal demand or legislation to restore the right to vote to every single American who has paid their debt to society, regardless of the crime that they have committed. There are structural barriers that we could indeed take in the short term to actually make these realities shift and change. So for us, we love the symbolic nature of what is happening because we think symbols do precede the kind of shifting and changing of hearts and minds. But I say this all the time, that the very people who created mass incarceration should not be the ones superintending the reform, profiting off of all the policy shifts and making, because I believe those very individuals would actually be aiming for the low-hanging fruit that would, as I say, scratch their itch, but leave the rest of us with a rash. And I believe that people who are directly impacted, fighting for their lives for the last several decades in the age of mass incarceration, should be at the front of the line at every single table of solution making and building so we can actually have solutions that change and shift these realities. And I hope and pray that that will continue to be a part of the president's agenda. We at the PICO Network have led multiple delegations of formerly incarcerated people into the White House to let their voices be heard, the Roy Austin, the domestic policy folks, some of the advisors of the president. So we think that they are moving in the right direction. We want to continue to compel folks that this is a moment where we should not let it get be squandered or hijacked by money interests and other folks that we think do not have the best interests of people in their mind.
So, Mike, I'm sitting in a radio studio, and you're at the other end of a phone somewhere, and I can still see the light of truth shining from your eyes. Pastor Mike McBride is the director of Lifelines to Healing, part of the PICO Network. He's also the pastor of The Way Christian Center in West Berkeley, California. Mike, as always, thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio, and we can't wait to have you back.
All right. God bless everyone. Take care.
You too. I'm Jack Moline. Welton Gaddy has the week off. There are so many exciting interreligious initiatives blossoming across the country and the world, as more of us realize how essential it is to recognize and respect the diverse beliefs defining our global community. I'm privileged to serve as the executive director of Interfaith Alliance, which has been doing this work for decades. Of course, Future Challenges Will Call for Future Leaders, and a new program from Andover Newton Theological Seminary and the Hebrew College in Massachusetts aims to address that need. I'm very pleased now to welcome Islamic scholar-in-residence Celine Ibrahim Lizio. Celine, welcome to State of Belief.
Hi, Jack. It's a pleasure to be here today.
Tell me, as a quick background, what's the history of the seminary and the Hebrew College working together?
Andover Newton Theological School is one of the oldest institutions in America. So it's been on a gorgeous hilltop in Newton Center for 200-plus years. And Hebrew College is one of the oldest institutions of Jewish learning in the country. So we're excited because of the proximity of this historic Protestant institution and this historic Jewish institution that we have an ability to train leaders very intensely within the communities with it, which they're a part. But then we also have this opportunity for cross-pollination of ideas and exchange. So one of the benefits of our programs that we value highly and that we find so unique is this ability to simultaneously go very, very deep into one's own spiritual tradition with others who are following that tradition, but then also have this opportunity for deep, authentic learning across religious lines.
Now, you yourself are in a unique role there. You're a chaplain, a scholar in residence. Can you tell us a little bit about your role?
My position is unique because I am jointly appointed. I serve both on the rabbinical school faculty and on the theological school faculty. And then in addition to teaching classes for students at the two schools, part of my role is to co-direct the Center for Interreligious and Communal Leadership Education, more affectionately known as CIRCLE. The role of CIRCLE is it's a program that stands between the two schools. We have three co-directors. One is a rabbi appointed to the faculty of Hebrew College. One is an interfaith studies professor on the faculty of Andover Newton. And then I complete this triad of interreligious leadership for CIRCLE.
Well, that sounds terrific, especially in terms of the interaction of the students. But can you tell us a little bit about the degree program itself? What is the degree and how does one acquire it?
We're so excited to be launching this fall our first cohort for the Global Interreligious Leadership Master's degree. And what we realized, we were getting so many solicitations, people who needed a person to work in their university institute for religious life who had competence dealing with people from a vast array of faith traditions. We were receiving nonprofit requests for directors of nonprofits that deal with religious leadership or that deal with diversity. We were getting requests from hospitals for chaplains that are competent in interreligious fields. And as we were getting these requests, we said, we have to make a degree program that can match these needs. And so really that's where the degree program was born. It was born out of these requests that we were getting as co-directors of this Interreligious Leadership Institute for competent people to be leaders in the world.
Is this an add-on to someone's theological studies for ordination as a minister, rabbi, or imam, or is this a separate degree program with its own title?
Mm-hmm. So the Global Interreligious Leadership degree, it's actually a two-track program. One track is sponsored by Hebrew College, and then the other track is sponsored by Andover Newton. And so a person can, let's say, for instance, you're a rabbi, and you know that a core part of your commitment is going to be an interreligious leadership. Then you'll pursue, for instance, your rabbinical degree at Hebrew College, but in the way, in passing, then you can do the core coursework for the Global Interreligious Master's. And so then when you leave not only with the rabbinical competencies, but then you also leave knowing how to be an effective rabbi in a large city such as Boston or Chicago, where you have to, by virtue of your leadership position, you have to be in conversation with the priest down the road, with the board of the mosque, with all these other organizations. And so we really feel that whether people want to do this degree as a standalone degree, or whether they like to bundle it with some other ordination credential that they're seeking. The program is designed to fit either one of those aims. We're also, I think, drawing people who are identifying as spiritual but not religious, in the sense that they feel passionate dealing with religious issues, thinking about ethical issues, thinking about the big meaning questions, and they don't want to particularly identify as Christian, as Jewish, as Muslim, but they want to be in an environment where people are deeply committed and who are wrestling with major meaning, questions of meaning. And so I think the degree is also attracting people for whom the quest for meaning in a spiritual sense, in a historical sense, in a contemporary sense, in terms of the way we relate to one another as communities, as civic bodies, I think this is the degree that also hits the mark between civic leadership and religious leadership.
Well, it sounds like a very wise program, and I have to say it is such a clear idea. I am surprised that nobody thought of this before you all did, but I'm very glad you're doing it. My guest is Celine Ibrahim Lizio, and we're talking about a new interreligious leadership degree program from Andover Newton Theological Seminary and the Hebrew College. Celine, what role do you see for trained interfaith leadership today and in the future?
Jack, I can't tell you. My computer is full of requests for people to come speak at events, people to come organize public service initiatives, people to come do campaigns for different social justice issues, leadership for nonprofits. Part of the reason we rolled out this degree program was that my colleagues and I couldn't handle the sheer volume of requests that we were getting to participate. And on one hand, it's like a movement that's just suddenly awakened and is across all of the United States in different pockets, different cities. There are interreligious organizations welling up. Civic organizations, nonprofit organizations are realizing the strength of the religious constituencies and wondering how to mobilize these constituencies. And it's not merely in the U.S. as well. We do a lot of traveling, and we're seeing some of the similar phenomenon overseas as well, that people are understanding that to talk about getting along and to talk about having unity and harmonious society, it's one thing to talk about it, but it's an entirely different thing to build it on the ground, brick by brick. And the knowledge of how to do that is not something that is necessarily intuitive. And so what we're doing in our program is making sure that we're training people in the best practices, that we're exposing people to what works and to what doesn't. And I'm always reminded as I look around the globe how frail our societies are. Even if we're sitting in a comfortable place in New Hampshire, it always strikes me that our societies are fundamentally so easily broken along sectarian lines. And if you want to mobilize people beyond their sectarian differences, whether that be religion or race or any number of things that divide us, there's a science to it. There's an art to it. And I think that we're just beginning to catch up in terms of actually thinking about how to teach that and to how to cultivate that. And it's really, I'm deeply honored to be a part of this work. And I think Hebrew College and Andover Newton are really on the cutting edge of thinking about what our societies need in terms of leaders, and then how to train that in a relatively short time.
Celine, you know, there are a lot of people who would suggest that when we talk about interreligious work, we're actually talking about finding some lowest common denominator, generic religion. How do you respond to them?
I think this is one of the points that we work incredibly hard with in our classrooms and in our activities and with students. Oftentimes I hear that exact sentiment. But what we try to do is say, sometimes representing the common denominator is a good start, but it won't really get you anywhere in terms of cooperation. It's like finding that point of commonality is like a honeymoon. But if you don't know how to go past, to work together past that honeymoon, you might find that your partnerships are not as robust as they could be. So it's OK okay to find the common denominator in some circumstances. But a lot of situations in the world, practically speaking, people are coming together because they have a deep difference that they need to reconcile. And so starting with a common denominator is one strategy. But oftentimes, if you can push people to realize that, one, not everybody is like them, two, that not everybody wants to be like them, and three, that that's okay and that you can still find ways to work together, that, I think, is one of the secrets to figure out how you do that and how you do that on a mass scale when so many people and so many interests and personal motivations are at stake.
If people want to know more about this program, where should they go?
We have a wonderful resource on our website, that's circleleadership.org. I should say as well that Circle also runs the Journal of Interreligious Studies. If there are scholars in the audience who would enjoy reading, we also run a blog for emerging religious leaders and ethical leaders. It's called State of Formation. We have a robust conversation that's going on about just about every social issue you can possibly imagine, from a wide range of religious leaders from across the globe, really.
Imam Celine Ibrahim Lizio is Islamic scholar in residence at Andover Newton Theological Seminary and the Hebrew College. The new interreligious leadership degree is an exciting project. Celine, I really, really appreciate your being with us today on State of Belief Radio, and I can't wait to talk to you again.
Thank you, Jack. It's been a pleasure.
Welton Gaddy has the week off. I'm Jack Moline. The saying might be, there's nothing new under the sun, but science challenges that statement on a regular basis. Such was the case this week as NASA's New Horizons became the first spacecraft to reach the dwarf planet Pluto. Our understanding of the solar system will change, but so might our spiritual systems. Back in 1969, when Neil Armstrong took that giant leap for mankind by walking on the moon, a minor crisis erupted in Jewish liturgy. A sweet little ritual acknowledging the new moon includes the words, "I leap toward you, but cannot touch you." Was that an appropriate thing to declare once humanity stood on the lunar surface? And now, all sorts of new information will change the way we look at the cosmos. How should that impact our spiritual perspective? Joining me now is my teacher and friend, Rabbi Elliot Dorf, professor of Jewish theology at the American Jewish University. Elliot, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you.
We have a pretty clear understanding of what ancient people were looking for when they looked to the heavens. What are we looking for today? It's not just pure science, is it?
No, I mean, I think it is definitely science, and that what we are going to find out from these new discoveries is more about the origins of the universe and more about the chemistry of how we are made and how the universe is made. And hopefully maybe even some facts about how we can avoid the kind of climate crisis that we seem to be hurtling into so that we can preserve the environment that sustains us. So hopefully all of those scientific things will be the result of this new discovery of Pluto and of whatever else we are able to discover as a result of this mission. But the other piece of it from a spiritual point of view is this can only add to the awesomeness of the universe that we live in. I mean, I don't go to religion to teach me science, but one of the things that religion does for me is that it gives me a sense of awe about the world around me so that I don't take it for granted and so that I'm able to appreciate everything from the intricacy of a leaf and the intricacy of my own body to the awesomeness of the universe. And this, if anything, makes that awesomeness even greater.
That's a great answer, especially because you managed to bring both Pope Francis and Abraham Joshua Heschel into one response.
I'm happy to do that.
There's a very real component of belief in the way we think about outer space. What does the way we look at worlds beyond tell us about humanity here on Earth?
Well, I think it first of all, gives us a sense of humility, which we human beings frankly need. It gives us a sense that we are very small in a very vast universe. And I think that that's at least one part of what the religious message to us has to be. One of my favorite Hasidic sayings is a person should have two pieces of paper, one in each of his or her pockets, one that says, for me the world was created, and on the other, I am but dust and ashes. So I am but dust and ashes is the humility part of what each of us has to have. On the other hand, we also have to have a sense of, for me the world was created, that is, that each of us has inherent worth given to us by virtue of the fact that we're created in the image of God, if you're talking about the Western religious traditions, and that as a result, we have to, on the one hand, appreciate our lives and do with them the best that we can to make them meaningful and to help contribute to the world at large. That's on the one side. And on the other side, we have to be appropriately humble about what we can do and what we have done.
You know, Elliot, your approach to Jewish life and practice has always included this brutal honesty about what science tells us. How is it that you maintain your faith when some of its presumptions are challenged so seriously by emerging knowledge?
I'm lucky by virtue of the fact that the Jewish tradition has dealt with emerging science really from the very beginning. So that, I mean, one of the things that I've always found rather amazing is that in the first century, a Jewish philosopher by the name of Philo in Alexandria interpreted the opening chapter of Genesis in terms of Plato's Timaeus, because that was the science of the times, the astrophysics of the time. 1,000 years later, Maimonides is, or 1,200 years later, is interpreting that same chapter in Genesis in terms of Aristotle's metaphysics, because that was the science of the time. After you get evolutionary theory, Darwin, and so on, you get Jews interpreting the first chapter of Genesis in terms of evolution. So in other words, I've inherited a tradition that uses, the Hebrew term is midrash, that uses the techniques of interpretation and reinterpretation to enable us to say our liturgy and to understand our sacred text in terms of modern science. So, for example, on every evening, Jewish liturgy, in the very first blessing of the evening service, talks about the awesomeness of the fact that there is day and night, and that there is the orders of the stars and the heavens, and the orders of the seasons. However, that paragraph does it on the basis of ancient science, where God rolls the night before the darkness and the darkness before the night. This is based on ancient science, where the world was flat and there was a dome above us, because when you look in the heavens, it looks like a dome. And the way that they understood the change from day to night and night to day was that the sun rolls on the inside of the dome from east to west during the day, and then it goes through an opening in the west and goes on top of the dome at night. That's why you don't see it. And then it magically reappears in the east in the morning, when it goes through another opening on the other end of the dome and then enters the on the inside of the dome. That was ancient science, and that's what's built into that prayer. Does that mean, now that we know that that's not the way that day and night happen, does that mean that we can no longer say that prayer? No, it just means that the point of the prayer is not the science. The point of the prayer is to make us aware of the awesomeness of the fact that the universe works. And that the various scientific laws that govern the universe actually work, so that we are able to exist. The very end of that prayer says, God, may you sustain this order forever, and which is really a prayer, because without that order, we could not possibly exist. I don't see any problem whatsoever in terms of incorporating science into my religious view, quite the opposite. I think that if I could not incorporate what we learned from science into my religious view, then first of all, I could never be honest about my own religion, and I could certainly never do what the Shema, a central prayer in the Jewish tradition, requires me to do. This is Deuteronomy chapter 6, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. I could never really do that. I could never integrate all of my being into my religious commitments unless I could be honest about what science is teaching me.
So on a clear Saturday night in Southern California, just after the new moon, do you look up in the sky and say, I leap toward you but cannot touch you? You still able to do that?
Sure. I still can't. I've never been on the moon. So for me, it still is indeed a true prayer. And even for, you know, Neil Armstrong or for some other person who, in fact, has been on the moon, at the moment that he or she is saying that prayer, they're not on the moon. But even, you know, let's say, just for the fun of it, let's just say that it was a Jewish person who happens to be now on the moon. Could that person say that prayer now while on the moon? Because I think basically that person could say, well, I happen to be on the moon at this moment, but in the vast majority of my life, both in the past and in the future, I'm not going to be able to step on the moon. It's just not part of my life.
Elliot, the knowledge we'll gain from New Horizons comes literally from the margins of our solar system. What should people of faith, Jewish or otherwise, look for at the margins of our belief systems?
I think in order to have a reasoned faith and an honest faith, which is something that I'm very committed to, that one has to be aware of and all of the frontiers of science. In this case, we're talking about astrophysics. But I think we have to be aware also of what science is telling us about sexual orientation and about how that works. And we have to adjust our own understandings of homosexuality and of heterosexuality based upon what we are learning from science. And I was just reading an article yesterday by a Muslim woman who's saying that she and her fellow Muslims really have to adjust what they believe about homosexuality given the new science involved. I think we have to do the same sort of thing in terms of how we apply our traditions to beginning of life issues, to end of life issues. As you know, I do a lot of bioethics, and that field has been immensely affected by the leaps and bounds that medicine has taken over the last 50 years or so. In the year 1900, life expectancy in this country was 45. In the year 2000, just 100 years later, it was close to 76. Most of that was public health measures, that, you know, the fact that we get vaccinated, the fact that we're taught to wash our hands before and after going to the bathroom and before meals, the fact that we have public health education that teaches us not to smoke and to drink alcohol only in moderation, and that teaches us that we have to worry about obesity. That has really educated us to take care of our health in ways that my parents and certainly my grandparents could not possibly have known were problematic and did not have the ways of avoiding diseases through vaccinations that we have. I think if religion is going to be real, it has to take into account what we are learning from science each and every day. And then it needs to integrate religious insights into how we understand science. So that what that means is that religious insights, both in terms of the kind of humility that I was talking about before, but also religious insights on the moral issues. So, for example, when we're talking about this mission into outer space, we're spending, from what I heard this morning, $700 million on this. I think that's money well spent, but I think it's also a real moral concern as to, do we spend money doing this, or do we spend money solving the issues of poverty or of climate change on our own, you know, on our own planet? I think that's a legitimate moral debate, and I think that there's room for both, but that we really have to take on these kinds of moral questions that science is posing to us. It goes back to the old Kantian point. Immanuel Kant, at the end of the 18th century, a philosopher in Germany, in Prussia really, pointed out that when you cannot do something, then you never have to ask whether you should, because you can't. But as soon as you can do something, then you do have to ask whether you should, because there are all kinds of things in life that you can do that you should not do. You can smoke, but you should not. You can abuse alcohol or drugs, but you should not. You can send a man to the moon, and you can send a probe into outer space, but does that mean that you should, especially given other needs that we have in society? And I think that that's a legitimate question, a legitimate moral question that science raises, and I think that there can be a variety of different viewpoints on that that are well-reasoned, but it's a discussion that we really need to have. In order to have a real faith, and a faith that affects us both as individuals and as a society, we must learn what science is telling us about ourselves and about the environment in which we live, and then we need to integrate both the insights of religion and of science, so that we can love God with all our heart, with all our soul, and with all our might.
Well, I'm just very glad that one of the guides we have on that journey is you.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Rabbi Elliot Dorf is professor of Jewish theology at the American Jewish University in California and chair of the Committee on Jewish Law and Standards of the Rabbinical Assembly. Elliot, thanks so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
My pleasure, Jack. Thank you.
Before we go, in case you think that recent Supreme Court decisions have muted the religious right, consider the recent words of Dr. Richard Land, longtime voice of Southern Baptists and current executive editor of the Christian Post. He takes aim at the American flag. Back in the day, showing disrespect for flag protocol could land you in a heap of trouble, most especially with the religious right. But how things change. The Treaty of Tripoli was ratified in 1797 by a unanimous vote of the Senate. Its history has to do with pirates and empires and the fledgling nation. But it is Article 11 that has the most relevance to conversations about the nature of our country today. It begins with the assertion that, quote, "The government of the United States is not, in any sense, founded on the Christian religion." Now, scholars have debated whether that phrase was indeed in the original, but there's no debate over this. When the Senate voted to ratify the treaty presented by President John Adams, who himself was a signer of the Declaration of Independence, they ratified that exact language. "The government of the United States is not, in any sense, founded on the Christian religion." I hasten to add that the government of the United States is not in any sense founded on the Jewish, Muslim, Hindu, Sikh, Buddhist, or any other religion. What is true, however, is that the culture of the United States is, and always has been, a Christian culture. As Americans, we are used to the inclusion of the Christian calendar, Christian practices, and Christian language in our society, almost always for a blessing. But just as we have come to embrace more expansive definitions of equality, freedom, and accessibility, we have come to be more inclusive about the place of a more diverse set of faith and ethnic communities in our culture. So it's understandable that some folks in our majority Christian population find this shift to be difficult. For centuries, a presumption of Christian dominance has been part of America. There is a certain logic, therefore, to presuming that the way it has been is the way it was meant to be. Take, for example, the Pledge of Allegiance. The first version was written in 1892 by Francis Bellamy, who was, ironically, a Baptist and a socialist. It gained in popularity over the next 50 years until Congress adopted it in 1942. The words "under God," however, were not added until 1954. And here we are, 60-some years later, dealing with a juicy piece of logic from our old friend Richard Land in an editorial just this week that he wrote in the Christian Post. Dr. Land suggests that churches that fly the Christian flag, a symbol introduced about 100 years ago, above the American flag, were actually enacting the intent of the Pledge of Allegiance, one nation, under God. That is, God first, nation second. It is a clever misreading of the word "under," but consistent with the impression that the real America is a Christian America. By the way, the Christian flag does not symbolize God broadly or metaphorically, but, as Dr. Land points out, the Savior for whose kingdom it stands. Now, you might be surprised to know that I applaud Richard Land for making his own commitments clear and for declaring that, in his value system, his religious values supersede his commitments to the law of the land. The Constitution guarantees his right to hold those convictions, and as long as they do not violate the law of the land, to live them out without interference from the government. You might be even more surprised to know that I empathize with his dilemma. Like an increasing percentage of Americans, I live my life just slightly out of sync with the dominant culture. My Sabbath is on Saturday. My holidays do not fall conveniently on Mondays or on days when the nation is at rest. And the language in which I pray and read Scripture is different than the language of the Constitution. Why, I even understand that there are Americans who have neither Sabbath nor Scripture. Imagine. But unlike Dr. Land, I celebrate that dissonance. Our country raises no barrier to full participation in the great marketplace of ideas. And if it turns out that what is right for we the people of the United States is different than what had been accepted as the default position by our forebears, well, ain't that America? We are a country not of American Christians, but of multiple loyalties. Those other loyalties may lead us to dissent in our private lives or religious associations, but our subscription to our common loyalty, the Constitution of the United States, is what protects that right of dissent. That's what the American flag represents. In a house of worship that places God above country, and I imagine that most houses of worship do, ought not to display the flag at all. That's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a very sincere thank you. Your support is essential to keeping this show on the air. If you find value in what you're hearing, I urge you to join our other generous supporters today with $10, $100, $1,000, or more. Please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can sign up for our free weekly podcast and find links that were mentioned during the show. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and share the stories you find compelling with your friends. We really need you to help spread the word. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. As the national political campaigns ratchet up their rhetoric around issues of reproductive freedom, LGBT rights, minority religious traditions, and so much more, our work in defending faith and freedom has never been more important. Find out more about our work and how you can get involved today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join Welton Gaddy next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. I'm Jack Moline, looking forward to hearing from you soon at Interfaith Alliance.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.